Flemington 507.
507, I've just received information from a source saying there's a Commonwealth Bank in Racecourse Road, subject of an armed robbery, shots fired, Ryan Road.
An armed robbery occurs every 90 minutes in Australia, and like a homicide, investigators rely on forensic evidence to help them catch the culprits. For members of the Armed Offender Squad who worked on this case, the evidence found was unusual and its combination unique, just like the actions of the thieves themselves.
Just before 10 o'clock, a armed cash carrier van arrived outside a disused bank in Flemington, an inner suburban location of Melbourne, where guards were tasked to refill two automatic teller machines in a bunker inside that disused bank. Once the two guards had finished their security checks, Muhammad took up a position outside the bank to scan the street, while Rebecca retrieved two carry bags containing the money to use to refill the ATM machines.
And it was at this time, as she was just entering the disused bank, that Muhammad had seen to his right two men jump out of the back of a red coloured ute. These two people were armed with firearms and wearing balaclavas. The driver was able to see in his mirrors the two offenders jumping out of the ute as well. He was aware instantly that these two men were there to rob them. He's then immediately driven from the scene, radioed his base, and provided them with the details of the armed robbery as it was being committed. Both Rebecca and Muhammad have then ran into the bank, into the bunker room, and in their haste, haven't been in a position to lock the door.
Get his fucking money! The door to the bunker was flung open.
Get his fucking money now!
A shot was fired first by one of the offenders.
Give me the fucking money now, come on!
And threats and demands were made for the money that was inside the bunker in the carry bags. Muhammad then returned fire in self-defense, as did Rebecca.
Give me the money, boy, you get it!
During the exchange of gunfire, the offenders were trying to reach inside the bunker to take the carry bags of cash. One of the bullets passed so close to Muhammad's head that he felt the shockwave and the heat of the bullet passing. It was at that point in time, Muhammad was in little doubt that he was going to die.
Muhammad realised that he was down to one round left in his firearm. He realised that on the next opportunity that the offender presented himself, he was going to fire upon him.
You fucking die!
There was silence in the bank, and Muhammad took this opportunity to reload his firearm. Then, one of the offenders screamed out, "You're going to die for this, boy. You're going to die.
You're going to die for it. Give me the money. Give me the fucking money now."
The offender reaches around the bunker room door again. Rebecca recalls seeing a yellow rigger's glove reach for the cash satchel. She takes aim and fires upon the offender, believing that she hits him.
There was a short pause, and it appeared to the guards that both offenders had left. They ran out the front in time to see the red ute driving down Racecourse Road. Muhammad tried to get the registration number, but it was too far ahead of him.
550 update, we got two offenders at least with handguns. We believe the offender was shot twice, we believe in the forearm. Roger.
The forensic team were immediately called in. If the offender had been shot, then his calling card may have been left behind.
Outside the bank, there was two pieces of wood located on the roadway. Those pieces of wood had a small amount of blood on them. There was also a small amount of blood on the tiles directly outside the bank as well. I collected swabs of that blood for DNA analysis, hopefully to identify the offender.
It was pretty clear to us that it was committed by people who have committed like crimes before, and we're hoping that whoever had committed the crime had been profiled and their blood was on the database.
As they waited for those results, the detectives followed more immediate leads.
A witness was actually riding his bicycle along Racecourse Road at the time of the armed robbery, and he saw two men wearing balaclavas and with guns run into the disused bank. This man actually believed there was a movie being made and went to investigate. He crossed Racecourse Road, went outside the bank, and tried to look inside to see what was going on with this movie. Unfortunately, the sunlight glare on the glass didn't enable him to see inside the bank, but he heard a further number of gunshots. He then became a bit dubious as to whether, in fact, this was a movie or a real-life offence. He then moved away from the front of the bank, and as he did so, the two offenders fled the bank on foot, ran to the red Ford utility, and drove off in Racecourse Road. This man obtained the registration number of the Ford utility.
Yeah, Flemington 252, I'll give you a description of the vehicle. The red Ford Ute, Delta Victor Charlie 574.
A quick check unsurprisingly discovered that the red Ute had been stolen. And within minutes, it had been found. But would there be enough forensic evidence left to catch their violent offenders?
Police are on the lookout for a gunman shot during an armed robbery this morning. $150,000 in cash was stolen when two balaclava-clad bandits ambushed guards during a routine delivery to refill a teller machine.
The shots all occurred inside the bank. There was no risk to passerbys, but it's certainly dangerous and a brazen attempt by the offenders.
I was notified by the crime scene unit to attend the scene of a shooting at an armed hold-up in Flemington. On arrival, I found that the scene literally looked like the shootout at the OK Corral.
Give me the money, boy!
There were 14 impact marks located within the area of the bank, and based on the damage left by the impact and the location of the two security officers and the two offenders, it was possible to determine that six shots had been fired by the male security guard, four shots had been fired by the female security guard, and four shots had been fired by the offender's revolver, two in the concrete floor, and a further two shots fired into the bunker, one striking the ATM machine, and the other striking the wall above the head of the male security officer.
But when the crime scene examiners collected the cartridges and bullets in the bank, it accounted for 16 shots.
That left two shots unaccounted for. It is possible that those two bullets have struck an offender and those bullets remained within the body or passed through to be caught up within the clothing.
The injured offender, who had left drops of blood on the footpath outside the bank, had escaped with his associate in a red ute. And that vehicle had just been found.
416, I found the car. That's on fire in Mulgrave Street.
30.500, we've got at least three to four witnesses here who've chased the offenders.
When we arrived at Mulgrave Street at that secondary scene, we were approached by a witness who stated he was driving along Racecourse Road at the time the armed robbery was being committed. He stated he saw the two offenders leaving the bank and jumping into the red ute. It was then that he decided to do a U-turn and began to follow this vehicle. He followed the red ute into Eastwood Street and then into Mulgrave Street. And at one stage, he actually thought about ramming that vehicle, but seeing the guns, he thought better of it. He then saw the red ute crash into the fence post. He was able to see the taller one getting out of the back tray. One of the offenders at this stage had taken his balaclava off, but the witness was too far away to actually get any sort of detailed description. He then saw the shorter offender pour liquid all over it and then set the vehicle alight. The offender returned and reached into the back of the now burning ute and grabbed out what the witness described as a bag or something similar. So he then watched in amazement as this man ran off down the laneway carrying a bag with one hand and trying to put out the fire with the other.
We've got two male offenders on foot who've headed south down the laneway off Mulgrave Street.
It was clear that it was the intention of the offenders to deliberately light the fire in an attempt to destroy all forensic evidence. But unfortunately for them, the fire wasn't that successful. There were several clues left to investigators, being the wardrobe that was partially burnt and the three firearms in the ute. I think it was not the intention of the offenders to leave these firearms in the utility. It was the sheer panic and the injuries sustained by one of the offenders during the armed robbery, where they've cleanly forgotten to take the firearms with them.
610 portable, we've got a trail of blood down the laneway. Permission from the 250 unit to follow that blood trail instead of waiting for a dog received.
Roger, Flemington 252, go.
252, permission granted.
Tubas south of the ute where it had crashed into a fence, there was a laneway. The laneway ran through to Smith Street. In that laneway, there was a blood trail that indicated one offender had been bleeding, and the amount of blood and the nature of it indicated that the offender had a substantial wound. We'd collected samples of that blood for subsequent DNA analysis. The blood trail ended abruptly at Smith Street, indicating that a further getaway vehicle may have been used.
There's a pool of blood. It looks like they stopped here for a split second and maybe stolen another car.
On the day of the robbery, we were contacted by the Armed Defenders Squad. I was asked to attend an address in Smith Street, Flemington. A witness had seen the two offenders running down a laneway and getting into a car outside a house.
I've got a basic description of both those males.
16, go.
One's around 185 centimetres tall.
She told me that she'd seen two males. One of them had a balaclava on. The other male had nothing on his face, and she saw his face quite clearly.
Second male, about 173 centimetres tall, thin to medium build. He was late 30s to 40s, with short, straight, dark-coloured hair.
I then conducted an interview with her to create a facial image of this male that was not wearing the balaclava. We produced the face, piecing it together like a jigsaw puzzle. We'll start off with the most distinctive feature of the face that the witness can remember, whether it be a hairstyle, a jaw shape, and we will then build that jigsaw puzzle together until we come up with a complete image.
Creating the face image could take between 1 hour and a day, and so another significant observation by the witness was out on the police airwaves.
All units, call has come through. Description of second vehicle that has been stolen. Registration is similar to Oscar double Victor 442. Described as a white Holden Commodore mid-80s. Rego comes up to expired 83 Mitsubishi sedan from a car yard in Benalla.
So then we started to wonder whether the plates had actually been stolen or the details that we'd been given were actually incorrect at the time. That led us to make a number of further inquiries and run variations of the number plates in relation to the numbers and letters that had been provided. As a result of these inquiries, it led to the discovery of a station wagon that had been stolen from the Middle Park area approximately 3 weeks earlier with the registration QVV 442.
The mistake, though minor, had meant the offenders were well ahead of the police. But they had picked the wrong car to steal and the wrong exit to escape. Within minutes of the robbery, the detectives knew they were dealing with professionals. But in stealing the $150,000 cash, one had been injured. Police now had alerts in local hospitals and were actively seeking the whereabouts of the second getaway vehicle.
In the hours following the armed robbery, we released a whereabouts desired in relation to the stolen Holden station wagon, QVV442. One of the avenues of inquiry that actually produced some information for investigators was an e-tag system on the new tollway in Melbourne, whereby a vehicle is fitted with a tag and it pings off a gantry on the roadway and they pay a toll. In the event that a car doesn't have an e-tag, it's recorded that the vehicle has passed the tollway without paying the appropriate fee. In this instance, we established that the Holden Commodore station wagon had travelled on the Balti Bridge along the tollway and had been captured by camera because they had not paid the appropriate fee.
Only 10 minutes after the robbery, the offenders had entered the tollway. And this road fed to a number of outer suburban areas. So as local patrols kept a lookout for the second stolen vehicle, the first was being inspected.
At this point in the inquiry, we were no closer to identifying who the offenders were responsible for that armed robbery. We returned to the yard where the stolen Ford utility had been secured to examine that or evidence that may have been in the vehicle that will assist us in identifying who the offenders are. When we got to the Ford utility, we identified there was rope and a pair of rigger's gloves we believed to be worn by the offenders during the commission of the armed robbery. And when we spoke to the owner of the red Ford utility, the owner identified to us that a number of wheels and tyres that had been in the car when it was stolen were no longer there, and also told us that remnants of a burnt wardrobe that were in the back of the utility did not belong to him.
And we re-canvassed the neighbours from where the cars were stolen from. We weren't able to turn up anything else to enlighten us to the identity of the offenders involved.
However, the guns that had been left behind in the burning ute were giving them a strong lead.
About a week after the armed robbery, the ballistic section contacted us and gave us information about the three firearms that were found in Mulgrave Street with the utility. They advised us that the two firearms, being the 12-gauge shotgun and the 22 rifle, had their serial numbers ground out. What they did tell us was the serial number in the revolver was able to be retrieved, and they linked that to an armed robbery that had been committed in January of 2001.
That was only 5 weeks before the one they were currently investigating.
Security guards and bank customers were forced to the ground at gunpoint last night when thieves robbed an armour guard van in Toorak.
This armed robbery was committed in similar circumstances in the fact that the two armed guards were about to do a refill on an ATM in Toorak when they were ambushed by two offenders at gunpoint. The guards, during the course of this armed robbery, were forced to the ground and had one of their firearms stolen, as well as the cash that they were about to refill that ATM with.
Once we discovered that the revolver used in the Flemington armed robbery was stolen from a guard in a previous armed robbery, we were confident that we were dealing with offenders who had committed at least one other, if not more, armed robberies prior to the Flemington armed robbery.
Their assumption appeared true. Like the gun, the blood found outside the bank had brought up a connection to another robbery, one that had remained unsolved for 5 years.
The circumstances of that burglary were that two offenders had broken in after hours into the shopping centre itself. They'd gone to the jewellery shop, broken an internal window and entered into the premises itself. They then smashed several of the display cabinets, and during the course of that, one of the offenders has cut himself. Upon investigating that jewellery burglary, the investigating police member obtained a sample of the blood. The jewellery burglary itself was a reasonably well-planned and executed burglary. A sum of about $50,000 worth of jewellery was taken.
The problem was that while the blood from this jewellery heist and the robbery matched each other, it had not uncovered a criminal from the DNA database. The good news was that the face image had been completed.
We put out a face system of one of the offenders together with a detailed description of the armed robbery to all police in Victoria and to armed robbery investigators in other states of Australia. It wasn't long before information started coming back into us that identified a number of persons of interest.
As a result of the internal email that we'd sent out, which detailed the fact that an offender was injured and may be seeking medical treatment, We received information from our Crime Stoppers and local police in Rye that they had information that a person by the name of Brian Gardner of the Rye area was in fact sourcing medical treatment. Brian Gardner was known to the members of the Armed Defender Squad, although his history mainly consisted of burglaries and lower type offences. In the early stages, he wasn't considered a suspect owing to the escalation and violence of the armed robbery in Flemington. On the receipt of that information from Crime Stoppers in Rye, he became our number one priority.
When detectives did a check on Gardner's address in Rye, they came up with several alternatives. Each needed to be checked out. But the Armed Offender Squad had other ideas than simply knocking on each door.
One of the considerations is that the Armed Offender Squad is searching for a person who is probably armed, is desperate and injured, and has displayed the propensity to use the firearm to prevent apprehension. Because of that, forced entry techniques are used to gain entry to the addresses.
The first premises we searched with our 20-pound key, also known as a sledgehammer, turned up no one was in that premises. Over the course of the next couple of hours, we then searched a number of houses, which again, failed to locate Gardner at any of those.
Was it possible that this prime suspect had flown the coop? Had word got out of the squad's arrival? Or did the police have the wrong intelligence? The Armed Offender Squad had raided several properties in which they believed their prime suspect may be hiding. Each was unsuccessful.
We cordoned off the area of Rye, ensuring that all the entry and exit points to it were covered by Armed Offender Squad personnel, in case word had got around to Gardner that we were in fact searching for him and he couldn't leave the area and flee. We did have several other known addresses, so we then had those premises set off. And by that I mean we had members from the Armed Offender Squad conduct some violence on those premises to see who came and who left.
One of those houses was proving interesting.
The two members were watching the address. They saw a vehicle leave the premises. It contained two males. They then followed that vehicle a number of kilometres. The vehicle was intercepted.
They then called upon the occupants of the car to leave the car. Of course, this is done at gunpoint, having consideration for the fact that we believe that one of them may be Brian Gardner and he probably will be armed.
One of the squad members then approached the back of the car where he saw a person to be seen there covered in what appeared to be a white sheet. He was called upon also to get out of the car but stated he couldn't. Again, he was called upon, responding, "I can't, I'm fucked, my arms don't work." The squad member identified this person to be Brian Gardner. We finally caught our man.
So they then secured him and took the sheet off and searched for firearms, which they found none. At that stage, they observed that his injuries consisted of his right arm being in a sling and his left arm all bandaged up. He was then removed from the vehicle and then placed under arrest. The arresting members of Brian Gardner then asked him about how and the circumstances of where he got his injuries, and he explained to them that he was shot through his left arm, which went through. He explained that he was shot in his right arm as well, but he believed that the bullet was still stuck in there and it had broken his bones. He stated to them he had no great plan in regards to getting medical treatment. He just hoped they'd get better. Gardner was then immediately conveyed to the Frankston Hospital, accompanied by two members of the Armed Offender Squad. Whilst being treated at the Frankston Hospital for his injuries, Gardner admitted to the investigating members that he'd been shot by security. He did admit any circumstances of the armed robbery, location of the money or who the co-offender was. So at this stage we're back to square one and we needed forensic evidence to link him to the crime.
Investigators obtained a swab from Gardner whilst in hospital, and this would be used to establish a DNA profile of Gardner and hopefully establish whether he was a person who deposited the blood at the crime scene in Flemington.
Brian Gardner then went under surgery and a bullet was removed. It had completely shattered on entry, and so would be of no evidential value in the case. So as detectives eagerly waited for results of the DNA tests, the house gardener was seen leaving was being searched.
As a result of a search on that address, we found numerous painkillers, bandages, and associated items in his bedroom, which he'd clearly been using to treat his injuries. Of significance, we also found a fat boy Harley Davidson in the lounge room. This bike appeared brand new, which showed to us that he'd come into some recent wealth. We then questioned his wife about that, and she said that they'd loaned a sum of about $25,000 to purchase that Harley Davidson. Again, we found this strange in the circumstances.
We spoke with the previous owner of the motorcycle and obtained an amount of information from him. He told us that Gardner attended at his home address to buy the Harley Davidson some 2 weeks before the armed robbery. Gardner had paid a small deposit and told the owner of the motorcycle that he didn't have all the money but would get it shortly, and when he did, he would return and complete the sale of the motorcycle. Gardner then left. A couple of days after the armed robbery, Gardner's wife went back to where the Harley Davidson motorcycle was and again spoke to the owner and paid cash, a total of about $25,000 in $50 notes to the owner of the motorcycle. In conversation, in passing, Gardner's wife did mention to the owner that she couldn't wait to get it back to the home address so that Gardner would feel better when he saw it.
So with the discovery of the bike, that explained at least $25,000 from the armed robbery. We still had a sum of money still outstanding. At this stage, we still had no idea where or what he had done with that money.
In a bedside hearing, Gardner was charged with attempted murder, armed robbery, and the theft of vehicles. And it wasn't long before that news was heard on the grapevine.
The night of Brian Gardner's arrest turned out to be busier than expected. Investigators were notified later that evening that the vehicle that they were still searching for, the white Holden station wagon, had been located at the back of the bank in the rear car park, partially burnt out.
It wasn't possible that the vehicle had been abandoned there before this night. This area was regularly patrolled. It's a very common area, which is patrolled by the local police on a fairly regular basis. We were quite happy with the fact it was left there that night.
There were two trains of thinking at this point in time. It was either the offender had thought that he had to get rid of all evidence still in his possession at this point in time, or it was a clear taunt to police, catch me if you can.
Are you Brian Gardner? Give me some help. Are you Brian Gardner?
Yes.
Brian Gardner was currently under police guard in hospital. So too was the white station wagon that had been used as a getaway vehicle in the armed robbery. It had just been found, dumped and partially burnt.
Inside the station wagon, we found a number of tyres, pieces of wood. I found pieces of wood that had a floral pattern on them and some money boxes. The money boxes were the kind of boxes that are used to fill auto tellers, and they had labels indicating they were for the Flemington auto tellers. A large vinyl bag was also found in the rear of the car, and that was what the money boxes would have been normally been carried in. In the front passenger area of the car, we located a substantial amount of blood, which indicated that the person who had been sitting there had bled quite severely. I took a DNA swab of that blood for further analysis.
We formed the belief that the blood would have been put there by Brian Gardner as he sat in the passenger seat, being driven by his co-offender from the Flemington area after the armed robbery. We took the owner of the station wagon to view the property in the station wagon to identify what, if any, of the property was his. He told us that the parts of the wardrobe, the wheels and tyres, and the tins and bag certainly were not his.
As well as having the owner of the stolen station wagon examine his vehicle, we had the owner of the stolen ute come and attend as well. He stated to us that the tyres that were in the back of the station wagon were the ones, in fact, that were in his ute when it was stolen.
The unsuccessful lighting of the fire meant that police now had a direct link between the two stolen vehicles. There was also the likelihood that the blood from the crime scene, the blood now found in the wagon, and the mouth swab from Gardner would all match. But as yet, there were no links or clues to his co-offender.
were still no closer to identifying who the second offender was. We're then going through a process of eliminating a list of persons of interest or including them in the inquiry when we received a phone call from the Altonmel police station. A person by the name of Michael Coates had presented himself to the police station saying the armed offender squad wanted to talk to him about the armed robbery in Flemington.
We thought this was unusual. Why would someone present themselves to the police station if they had no knowledge of the armed robbery? It was a very curious thing for us and obviously something we had to explore.
On arrival at Altona North Police Station, I observed that Michael Coates was quite similar to both the build described and the face image provided by the witness from Flemington. As a result, Michael Coates was placed under arrest in the event that any admissions he's made could be produced in court at a later date.
I intend to interview you in relation to the offence of armed robbery. Before continuing, I must inform you that you're not obliged to say or do anything, but anything you say or do may be given in evidence. Do you understand that?
Yes, I do.
During the formal interview of Michael Coates, the clear question to me was, why had he come to police? During this interview process, he said he'd read a newspaper article that a man had been injured during an armed robbery in Flemington. The man had been located in the Rye area and had gunshot wounds.
Now, I am a suspicious person by nature, and I thought it might be someone I know, and thought, well, if it is, you'll be around to see me. No one came around to see me. Someone came around at 9 o'clock this morning and said that you people were after me, so I came to see you.
Okay. That person, was that a police officer?
No.
Okay, just so we're not speaking in riddles and we understand, the newspaper article, who did you, in your own mind, who did you think that person to be?
No comment.
Okay, Michael, I'd just like to put some allegations to you in relation to why you have been arrested. It's alleged that on the 25th of January 2002, an armed robbery took place at the disused Commonwealth Bank complex. Flemington, what can you tell me about that?
No comment.
Did you have any involvement in the commission of that armed robbery?
No comment.
Do you know any person that did have any involvement in that armed robbery?
No comment.
Michael, is it your intention to answer no comment to the rest of my questions in relation to that armed robbery?
Correct.
I was somewhat baffled that this person had presented himself to a police station, saying that we wanted to speak to them and that he would answer questions, then exercising his right to not answer those questions.
I just couldn't work out why this man presented himself, then wanted to play cat and mouse with us. It was really quite strange at the time.
I'll move on in relation to some questions in relation to forensic procedures.
We asked him if he would present his arm so we could do an inspection to see if there was any evidence available that would be consistent with that of the second offender. As he's rolled up the cardigan arm to his right arm, lo and behold, we find a burn mark that's consistent with that of the second offender may have received when he was reaching into the rear of the utility to get the cash bag out of the car. He said he'd received it during a Sandy accident during the repair of a motor vehicle. We organised for the forensic medical officer to come in and to view that injury, and she said that it was consistent with a recent burn. We couldn't believe Michael Coates could be so stupid to present himself. He now fitted the description and had an injury consistent with the second offender.
Police had two suspects. Gardner, who admitted being shot, but not admitting that he had been at the armed robbery. And now Michael Coates, who had turned himself in, but hadn't. So in this cat and mouse game, they needed to find solid evidence. Luckily for police, Coates had driven in that day.
Michael Coates also gave him the keys to his car, and when I searched the car, I found in the glove box of the car a lease agreement to an address in Lock Street, Yarraville. Of particular interest in this lease agreement were the dates on the lease agreement. They extended prior to and just after the armed robbery committed in Flemington. The real estate agent also supplied us with information relating to the lease agreement, and on that lease agreement, Brian Gardner was noted as a referee of Michael Coates.
Michael Coates had just walked into a police station, saying that the armed offenders squad were looking for him. They weren't, but his appearance had now led them to search a house he had rented during the period that the armed robbery had occurred.
We then searched the premises in Lock Street, Yarraville. We found a number of significant items in that premises, things including bloodstaining on the floor near the back door, a pair of bloodstained tennis shoes, bandages which appeared to be bloodstained in the lounge and living areas of that premises. And of significance, we found a cupboard, and in that cupboard was a very distinctive green patterned floral adhesive which matched that of the wardrobes and cupboards we recovered from the stolen station wagon.
Not only were the shelves a link between the house and the white Commodore, but forensic investigators were also finding links between the house, the white Commodore, and the ute.
When I compared the property located in both of the stolen vehicles, the ute and the station wagon, there were remnants of wardrobe in both. There was a particular type of hinge found in both of the vehicles, having a U shape and also being painted white over green. The same design was used for both hinges. It showed that they were probably from the same era and possibly even from the same cabinet.
In the laneway, not far from the house, there was further evidence. More remnants of a wardrobe, the frame of which was identical to that from the ute. And if there was any doubt these discarded wooden items didn't belong to the property, the owners of the house were about to put a stop to that.
They were able to tell us that they had three cupboards missing. The same three cupboards had the distinctive green floral pattern adhesive on them. Those wardrobes in particular belonged to that address. That address at the time being rented by Michael Coates. It all married up together.
And the links didn't stop there.
In the garage, which was attached to the rear of the premises, we found a piece of rope. That rope was immediately recognisable as being the same kind that we recovered in the back of the red ute.
This rope had the same dimensions and the same twist and structure as the rope from the ute. So therefore, I could conclude that it was likely that they may have originated from the same source.
Also in the garage were tyre impressions. One perfectly matched the tyre tread found on the white Commodore station wagon. But this car wasn't the only one linked to the property.
Members of the armed offender squad canvassed residents in Lock Street, Yarraville, and from that they identified a number of witnesses. One of whom observed a gold-coloured Ford Fairlane sedan parked at the front of the Lock Street address in the days prior to and after the armed robbery in Flemington. It was also seen that a person had retrieved what appeared to be a gun case from the back of the Ford Fairlane and taken it inside the Lock Street address. Of significance, the person described was not dissimilar in appearance to Brian Gardner. Brian Gardner had, in fact, owned a 1979 Ford Fairlane sedan, and it was gold in colour.
As a further part of checking the surrounding area of Lock Street, Yarraville, we came across a medical centre. We established that Michael Coates had, in fact, been to that location on several occasions post the armed robbery. And received several scripts for painkillers. That was significant to us for the fact that it was pretty clear that those painkillers were bought in an effort to assist Gardner who'd been shot.
Brian Gardner and Michael Coates were definitely linked to the house. But more importantly, when the DNA results came back from Gardner's mouth swab, it was a perfect match to items in the house, to the blood in the white Commodore, to the laneway near where the ute had been burnt, and outside the bank.
Brian Gardner had already been arrested and charged for the armed robbery and attempted murder of the two security guards. The blood sealed the case. Michael Coates, on the other hand, had been charged only as an accessory, but that was about to change.
Having obtained all the evidence we had from Lock Street and the associated evidence, we then attended at the Smith Street address and spoke to the witness who saw the unmasked offender on the day of the armed robbery in question. We showed her a series of photographs in which she was able to identify positively Michael Coates as being the person she saw in the laneway on the day of that armed robbery. We now had significant evidence to link Michael Coates to his involvement in the commission of that armed robbery.
We then went out to the Mount Street address, rearrested him and took him to the office of the Armed Offender Squad, where we gave him the opportunity to explain his actions if he wished to do so.
Okay, Michael, it's alleged that you and the company with Brian Gardner attended at the disused bank, whereby you confronted two armoured guard employees doing an automatic telling machine refill. What do you have to say to that?
Wasn't, mate.
It's also alleged, Michael, that during this gunfight, that a quantity of cash in the vicinity of $150,000 was stolen from guards at this time. What do you have to say to that?
I know nothing about that.
It's further alleged, Michael, that during this time, you have fled with Gardner to a stolen Ford Utility, red in colour, that was parked out the front of the branch, registration DVC574. What do you have to say to that?
No, it wasn't me.
This armed robbery was clearly well planned and well executed until the point where Brian Gardner was shot. At that point in time, things went tragically wrong. Their escape didn't go smoothly. They crashed the red utility, they set that on fire, they leave the guns behind. Initially, they leave the money behind. Michael Coates catches himself on fire. It all went wrong. They weren't in a position to dispose of the secondary vehicle. They had to hang on to that. Nothing went right from the time that they left the bank.
Michael Coates was informally charged with armed robbery, attempted murder and theft in relation to the two cars used in the armed robbery and of the $150,000 stolen during the course of the armed robbery. He was then remanded in custody to spend time with Brian Gardner.
Do you wish to say anything in answer to the charge?
No comment.
Do you wish to make a further statement in relation to this matter?
No.
I really have no reason why Michael Coates contacted police on the day when he presented himself at Altona North. There's obviously several schools of thought. One was that he was that arrogant that he believed that whatever we were able to find out would never be able to link him to the case in question. It still baffles me, and I'm sure sitting where he is now, he'll have a lot of time to think about it. But it certainly was his undoing by presenting himself to the police on that day.
At their trial, both men contested the attempted murder charge, but Gardner, unlike his co-accused, pleaded guilty to the armed robbery and the theft of the vehicles. They were found guilty of those two charges, but acquitted on the attempted murder.
Gardner was sentenced to 8 years imprisonment and Coates was sentenced to 7 years imprisonment. The Victorian Director of Public Prosecutions later appealed the leniency of these sentences and the appeal was upheld and new sentences of 11 years was imposed with a non-parole period of 8 years. Both Coates and Gardner are eligible for parole in the year 2010.
Gardner was charged with the jewellery burglary where he pleaded guilty and received a 12-month term of imprisonment. Unfortunately, we weren't able to produce enough evidence for the Turek armed robbery and that case remains open.
The two security guards involved in the Flemington armed robbery have left their jobs. Brian Gardner, who caused them to be so traumatised, has, as a result of his actions, been left with a damaged right arm. He may never be able to ride a Harley again. The remainder of the money is still missing.